They hurried to the base of the pillar and climbed the wide spiral staircase. It brought them out into a small vestibule planted with colourful bushes from several worlds, their flowers reaching for the open sky above. 10 doors opened off it. Jessorel led the way into the main lounge. In contrast to the exterior, the lounge was clad in caronwood, a local variety that was a rich gold-brown. The grain of the planks had been blended so skillfully, it looked as if they were inside a giant hollowed-out trunk. Its furniture was scarlet and gold, contributing to the sumptuous feel. Doshiko was waiting in the middle of the big room, holding out a tumbler of malt whiskey with 3 ice cubes. He had a mischievous smile on his broad face.
Welcome home.
Thanks. Oscar took the drink wearily. I see Jessorel's restraint is as strong as ever.
I didn't tell him,
Jessorel protested.
So?
Oscar inquired. Doshiku raised an eyebrow and half-turned, indicating the balcony beyond the glass wall at the far end of the lounge. Anja was standing out there, leaning on the rail as she spoke about some aspect of the gardens below. Her laughter-filled voice was just audible through the open door. Oscar knew the tone well. She was playing the perfect hostess, marking her territory. Anja was astonishingly beautiful, a beauty that took a full third of her salary to maintain. 2 visits to a clinic each year were considered an essential minimum, for beauty was fluid and fashions were treacherous ephemera, even on Oricum. She'd returned 3 weeks earlier from her last treatments, showing off her reduced height and dark satin texture skin. Her face was all gentle curves, veiled by a mane of thick chestnut hair swishing down past her shoulders. Huge, fawn-coloured eyes peered innocently out of the shadows, projecting a girlish innocence complemented by a perpetual ingenue effervescence into the Gaia field. Her clothes were deceptively simple, a scarlet T-shirt and dark blue swirling skirt demonstrating her compact figure's expensive femininity. Yet for once, Anja wasn't impressing the person she was talking to. Oscar watched the other woman leaning on the rail. She was easily half a head shorter than Anja, wearing a stylish white dress with a slight surface shimmer and a rust-red short-sleeved jacket. She was not responding with the kind of attention Anja was used to extracting from everyone she came across. He could tell. After 10 years, Anja's body language and the tone of her voice were an open book. And the more she failed to impress, the more huffy she got. He even allowed some of his amusement to trickle out into the Gaia field. Anja must have sensed it. Her full lips hardened into a rebuke as Oscar walked toward the balcony.
Oscar, darling, I've been talking to an old friend of yours.
The other person on the balcony turned around, smiled shrewdly. Oscar dropped the tumbler as his hands, along with every other part of his body, were shocked into loss of sensation. The crystal smashed, sending the ice cubes bouncing across the polished wood.
Hello, Oscar,
Paula Mayo said.
Holy shit. Long time no see.
Oscar couldn't even grunt. Alarm was starting to seep into the Gaia field as his life partners took in the tableau.
You two,
Jessorel said, his fingers rising to point accusingly at Paula.
I thought...
It's all right,
Oscar managed to croak.
What is this?
Jessorel said accusingly to Paula.
You said you were friends.
We used to be. A long time ago.
That old excuse. Again. Everything happened before I was born.
Everything did, Oscar said. His U-shadow summoned a maid bot to clean up the broken tumbler. Only then did he finally manage a weak smile.
How are you doing, Paula?
Same as usual.
Yeah. She had not changed, not physically. Nothing was different, except maybe her straight dark hair was a couple of centimeters longer. Unlike him, who had been given a great new advancer body based on his own DNA, and then enriched with all the macrocellular clusters and stronger bones, more efficient organs, and greater longevity. After 86 years, he still wasn't anywhere near needing rejuvenation, although his face was starting to show signs of his newly lived years, as Anja never tired of pointing out. But her, he guessed she must be higher now. Somehow he could not see her visiting clinics for vanity's sake.
You do
know each other then? Dushiku asked uncertainly.
Yes.
Oscar cleared his throat. Could you give us a moment, please? His life partners exchanged troubled glances, flooding the Gaia field with concern and considerable irritation. We'll be outside, Anja said, patting his arm as she went. Just yell. The maid bot waddled into the lounge and started sucking up the malt. Oscar backed up to a settee and sat down hard. The numbness was dissipating, replaced by a growing anger. He glared at Paula. 1,100 years. Thanks for that.
I recovered your memory, Sal.
You put it on trial.
You're as alive now as the day you flew the hyperglider. That's more than can be said for your victims at Abaddon.
Jesus fucking wept. Will you stop persecuting me?
I can't make you feel guilty. You do that to yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
He sank deeper into the cushioning. What the hell are you doing here?
You live well.
She turned her head, studying the lounge. Anja was quite proud of the house.
I can see why.
My CST retirement and rejuve pension fund was paid over into a trust the day the trial ended, courtesy of Wilson. You want to know what 1,100 years interest looks like? You're standing in it. Bloody inflation. I should have been able to buy a planet.
And your life partners. They're good people.
Jesseral is rather young, isn't he?
Yeah. Oscar growled at her. He's also got a very big cock.
Paula smiled. Did you ever get in touch with Wilson when you were relifed? He left a message. So did Anna. They both downloaded into ANA long ago, which frankly I don't admire. Look, this is bullshit. What the fuck do you want?
I need you to do a job for me.
Oscar would not have believed it possible he was in the same room as Paula Mayo and laughing at her.
Oh boy, did you ever lose it over the centuries? You want me to do a job for you?
You've got to be fucking joking. Paula's answering smile veered toward the immoral.
Exactly.
Oscar's humor vanished abruptly, leaving him with a very queasy sensation heating his stomach.
Oh, shit. You're not joking.
Of course not. It's a perfect arrangement. Who would ever suspect such a thing? No. No chance. Go and blackmail someone else. I'd rather go back into suspension.
Come on, Oscar. You're not Jesseral. So stop acting like him.
I'm not here to threaten. I'm here to ask because I know you and I know what you want.
You do not know me, lady.
Paula leaned in toward him, her eyes shining.
Oh, yes, I do, Oscar. We spent the last few years of your life together.
I nearly died, and you did.
Don't tell me we don't understand each other. You martyred yourself so that the human race could survive.
You are an honorable man, Oscar.
Screwed up by guilt, but honorable.
Oscar was doing his best not to be intimidated by her. That was a mad situation. It won't ever happen again.
Oh, really? Who do you think I work for these days?
I'll take a wild guess and say ANA. You never change.
You're right about ANA, but wrong about change. I am different.
Yeah, it looks like it. The same job for 1,300 years. I barely recognized you.
Paula, you can't change. That is you.
Far away altered me. It nearly killed me. But I understood I had to adapt. So I resequenced my DNA to edit out the compulsive behavior trait.
It shows.
Self-determination can overcome artificial nature. I'm sure the old nature versus nurture philosophers would be delighted to hear it. Why don't you call them and let them know?
Oh, yes, right. They're all dead for 2,000 years. You're trying to avoid answering me.
Trying to justify your fright to yourself? Wrong, lady. Utterly, totally wrong. The answer is no. No, I will not help you.
Would you like that clarified? No.
How bad do you think it is? That I'm here to ask you.
Don't care. I won't help you.
It's the pilgrimage.
Oscar, I'm worried about it.
Really worried.
He stared up at her, not sure if he could take many more shocks.
Look, I've followed the story closely enough. Who hasn't?
The Navy will stop the Arcusan Empire dead in its tracks. ANA will halt the pilgrimage ships. It's not stupid.
The void will eat up half the galaxy if Inigo's dumbass sheep ever get inside.
And you think that's all there is to it?
Oscar, you and I were there with Nigel before we travelled to far away. You know how complex that situation was, how many factors were in play.
Well, this is worse.
A lot worse. The void is only a peripheral event. A convenient gadfly. This is the factions finally marching out to fight. This is a battle for the destiny of humanity. Our soul will be decided by the outcome.
I can't help, he said, mortified by the way his voice was nearly a wail. I'm a pilot, for Christ's sake.
Oh, Oscar.
Her voice was rich with sympathy. She knelt down in front of him and grasped his hands. Her fingers were warm to the touch.
Enough humility. It's your character I desperately need help from. I know that once you agree, I don't have to worry about the problem anymore. You won't quit on me, and that's what's important.
This is a nostalgia trip for you. I'm just a pilot.
You were just a Navy captain, but you saved us from the Starflyer. I'm going to tell you what I'm asking you to do, and then I'm going to tell you why you'll do it. If you want to hate me for making you face reality, then that's fine by me too.
He shook his hands loose from her grip. Say your piece, then go.
The factions know me. They watch me as I watch their agents, so I can't have them knowing that I am desperate to locate the second dreamer.
Oscar laughed. It trailed off into a near whimper.
Find the second dreamer? Me?
Yes. And you know why that'll work?
Because no one will be expecting it. He made it sound like a school kid reciting a useless fact.
Correct. And do you know why you'll do it for me? And please don't shoot the messenger.
He braced himself. Surely there was nothing else in his life she could threaten him with. Did I erase a memory? My God, was there another Abaddon?
What? Because you're bored shitless with this dreary, monotonous life you sleepwalk through.
Oscar opened his mouth to shout at her, tell her that she'd finally flipped, that she was so fantastically wrong, that his life was rich, that he had people who loved him, that every day was a joy, that he never wanted to go back to the crazy days of the Starflyer War, that he'd already endured all the terror and wild exhilaration one life could possibly contain, that such things were best left to the new generation. But for some reason, his head had fallen into his hands, and he was sighing heavily. He could not look at her, and he certainly never could look at his life partners.
I can't tell them that, he whispered painfully. How can I? They'll believe it's their fault.
Paula stood up. A hand rested on his shoulder with gentle sympathy.
You want me to do it?
No. He shook his head and wiped the back of his hand across his eyes to remove the annoying smears of moisture.
No. I'm not that much of a coward. Whatever cover story you need, you've got it. I can arrange anything, basically.
There's a starship waiting for you at the local spaceport. She smiled mischievously.
An ultra drive.
Oscar smiled faintly, feeling the joy stirring deep inside him. Ultra drive? Well, at least you don't think I'm a cheap whore. This was not how Araminta had expected to be returning to the Suvorov continent, sitting in an aging carry capsule as it flew across the great cloud ocean, lower and slower than every other capsule on the planet. It didn't exactly smack of style. She'd always promised herself she'd return to her birth continent only when she could step out of a swanky luxury capsule and smile condescendingly around at Langham and the family's business. Not there just yet. Unfortunately, Lycan's estate was on Suvoro, understandably, as that was where Vyosha's capital, Ludor, was situated. Lycan was not a province's kind of person. He had to be near the action. So back across the ocean she went, with a baggage hold packed with her best clothes and a deepening sense of anxiety. She was genuinely interested in the Sheldonite's abilities. To get to his level in under 150 years illustrated a phenomenal achievement. There was a lot she could learn from him, providing she could get him talking.
Then there was the whole Sheldonite culture thing. Thousands of people on hundreds of external worlds trying to emulate their ancient hyper-capitalist idol. It was an emulation dangerously close to blind worship, she thought, but she was willing to suspend judgment until she experienced it firsthand. Maybe this was the route she should be taking. Even Bovey could not deny that Sheldonism was the pinnacle of business culture. Successful Sheldonism, that was. There were enough failed adherents littering the external worlds. And finally, the harem. Typical male fantasy, a rich man making his dreams come true. Yet it was a lot more common than in Sheldon's day. Group life partner relationships were growing in popularity in the external worlds. And she was hardly in any position to criticize. What she'd enjoyed with Bovey was essentially the same arrangement. So here she was, technically free and single, and still interested in experimenting sexually to see what suited her. She didn't think this was going to be her, but she had surprised herself before with Bovey. A last wild fling, then. So whatever I discover, this weekend will be win-win. With that delinquent thought warming her, the capsule finally made land and began to fly over Lycan's estate. He owned an area of 100,000 square miles, taking in a long stretch of coastline, developed with resort complexes. Massive tracts of farmland with square-mile fields were growing every imaginable luxury crop, the kind nobody produced in a culinary unit, tended by over 1 million agrobots, all processed in immaculately hygienic cybernated factories and sold under his own brands. Then there was Albany, his industrial complex. Set on a flat plain, it was 8 miles to a side, with tall boxy buildings laid out in a perfect grid, every one a factory or processing plant. A spaceport spread out of one side, with long rows of landing pads stretching across the green meadows to a nearby river. Ocean barges clotted the water, and fat cargo starships formed nearly solid lines stretching up through the sky. No humans lived in Albany itself. The technicians who kept it running were housed in dormitory towns 20 miles away. She flew over one of them, surprised by how nice it looked, with large houses and plenty of green space, ornate civic buildings providing every amenity. He owns it all, and more, he created it. Now that is real vision. Her capsule's net was queried by local traffic control. She supplied her identity certificate and received a descent vector. Lycan's home was actually 3 separate buildings. 2 of them were on the shore of a lake 10 miles long. One was a giant chateau made of stone that must have had 500 rooms. Araminta had seen smaller villages. The second, almost opposite the first, was an ultramodern ovoid of shimmering opalescence that seemed to dip down into the water as it lay alongside it across the ground. The third was small by comparison, just a wooden lodge atop the cliffs of a rugged island. The capsule landed outside the ovoid. Araminta was quietly grateful. She wanted to see what it was like inside, if there were any design concepts she could use. 2 of the harem women were waiting to greet her when she stepped out. Clemence, a slim teenager, dressed in a simple white shirt and blue cotton shorts, had a fresh face, freckles on her nose and brow, an eager smile, and fair hair that was barely styled. She was not quite what Araminta had expected. The other one, Maracata, was tall and classically beautiful, with ebony skin that gleamed in the sunlight. Her scarlet gown probably cost more than every item Araminta had brought put together, and that's what she wears in the middle of the afternoon. Subtle cosmetic scales highlighted jade eyes and a wide mouth. She did not smile. Her whole attitude was one of cool amusement. Clemence bounded forward, her smile growing even wider. She threw her arms around Araminta.
Lycan has told us all about you. It's so great to finally get to meet you.
A mildly startled Araminta gave the girl a tentative hug. What did he say? To be careful, Maracata said. She raised an elegant eyebrow, observing Araminta's response.
He says you're really ambitious and smart and attractive, and your own boss.
Clemence seemed to run out of breath.
Just all around fabulous.
Araminta finally managed to disentangle herself from the girl. I didn't realize I'd made such an impression. Lycan makes very fast assessments, Maricato said. Do you? Araminta asked as coolly as she could. It actually drew a small smile from the imposing woman. I take my time and get it absolutely right. Good to know. Clémence giggled. Come on, we'll show you your room. She grabbed Araminta's hand and pulled like a 5-year-old hauling her parent to the Christmas tree. The staff will get your bags, Maricato said airily. Araminta frowned, then saw she wasn't joking. A couple of women in identical smart grey toga suits were heading for her capsule, followed by a regrav sled. You have human staff? Of course. So Nigel Sheldon must have had them. You are quite quick, aren't you? Clémence laughed and pulled harder. Come on, I chose this one for you. They were right up against the scintillating surface. Araminta had not realized how big the ovoid was. It had to reach 10 stories above her, though the curvature made it hard to tell. There were no discernible features, certainly no door. The entire base was surrounded by a broad marble path, as if it were resting on a plinth. A couple of thin gold lines had materialized underfoot, which Clémence had followed. She slipped through the torrent of multicolored light. Araminta followed. It was similar to walking through a pressure field or a spore shower. A slight tingle on the skin, a bright flash against the eye, and she was in a bubble chamber with transparent furniture delineated by glowing emerald lines, like curving laser beams. Closets and drawers were all empty. Chairs and couches contained a more diffuse glow inside their cushions, looking like faulty portal projections. The floor and cupola walls were a duller version of the external scintillations. Only the cream and gold sheets on the bed were what she thought of as tangible. The house, SmartNet, is offering an operations program, her U-Shadow told her. Accept it. Her exovision showed her the file opening into a storage lacuna. Clémence already was sitting on the edge of the bed, bouncing up and down. Like it. The house's main entrance opens into a guest bedroom. Only when you need it to, the girl said sprightly. Tell your control program you want to see out. Araminta did, and the walls on one side lost their luster to show the gardens outside and her capsule with the regrav sled loading cases. Now, if you need the bathroom, Clémence said. The whole room started to slide upward, following the curvature of the external wall. There must have been excellent gravity compensators hidden somewhere below the floor, because Araminta did not feel any movement. Then they were sliding horizontally into the center of the ovoid. Other bubble rooms flowed past them. Araminta imagined this was the perspective corpuscles had as they raced through a vein. She smiled in delight. How brilliant. The whole thing is protean. Her bedroom touched a bathroom, and the wall rolled apart to give her access. The design beyond the new door was more conventional, with a huge pool bath, showers, and dryer chambers. It was bigger than the living rooms back in the apartments she was developing. You want to see someone? Or go to the dining room for dinner? Or just change the view? Tell the house, Maricato said. I will, Araminta said positively. A door opened opposite the bathroom, and Maricato stepped through. Araminta caught a glimpse of an all-white chamber with a long desk and gym apparatus. I'll see you later, Maricato said, and the door swept shut behind her. Was that a threat? Araminta muttered. Oh, ignore her, Clémence said. She's always shy around new people. She's a lot more fun in bed, honest. I'm sure. Araminta turned around, giving the room a more thorough inspection. The drawers began to fill up with her clothes. The process was like watching water bubble into a glass. Take me to Lycan, she told her U-Shadow. The room closed the door into the bathroom. Curving walls slipped past horizontally, then curved to vertical. And opaqued the walls. Gravity might be perfectly stable, but the sight was strangely disorienting. Lycan's room was huge. Araminta suspected that it didn't move often because everything else in the house would be displaced. It was circular, with a polished oak floor that appeared to be a single giant segment. It had been vat-grown. She had read a file on the process in one of her design courses. The walls were pale pink and blue with a translucent eggshell texture. They slipped into transparency along a third of the length, providing a panorama across the lake. Lycan was walking toward her, dressed in a simple mauve sweatshirt and long green shorts. Small coloured symbols were shrinking around him, and then vanishing. The walls had to be portals, she thought, which gave them a vast projection capacity. This was probably his office. He smiled warmly, paused in front of her and gave her a kiss, the kind of kiss that told her what he was expecting from her later. "Great house," she said. "I knew you'd like it. The concept is an old one, but we've just gotten the manufacturing process down to an affordable level. Not easy without higher replicators. I'd like to have the Colwyn City franchise." He responded with a warm, admiring smile. "See, most developers would have made a crack about me putting them out of business, but you see how to adapt and move onward. That's what makes you stand out. Thank you." Clément scampered over to a new door. "Catch you later." Lycan waved dismissively as he led Araminta over to the transparent wall. "Drink? Food?" he asked. "I'm good for a few hours." "Good. The Prime Minister and two Cabinet Ministers are coming for dinner. Are you trying to impress me?" "They were coming anyway, but it gives you an idea of the life I lead. To get this big, you have to delve into politics. Colwyn City Hall can be a beast about issuing permits. Take the development officer for dinner. Loan your local councillor a high-end capsule. They're all in it for what they can get. Wouldn't be feeding from the public trough otherwise. Unless they're in it to clean up the corruption. Yeah, those ones are a problem. Fortunately, they don't tend to last long. You're a cynic. Pragmatist, if you don't mind. I'm also a lot more experienced than you in every field. So trust me when I say politicians all have their weaknesses." "What's yours?" she teased. "One, I'm an easy lay, but you already know that. Two, risk. Risk is my weakness. The sensation when a risk pays off is like nothing else. I always take the risk. I enjoy the reward too much not to." "So, what risk are you taking right now?" "You're smart. You've researched me. The finance files, at least. Tell me." "I accessed some background on my way over. Opinion is you're dangerously overextended, and those loans have grown significantly in the last couple of years. So why do you think that is?" "You're going to wipe out property companies with houses like this one? Flood the market?" He grinned. "Small scale. I think big. Besides, it'll take a decade for something like this to become fashionable and then generally accepted. Think. What's the most pressing problem Vyosha has today? Living dream? Kind of. Alezzelin is always looming over us, rightly so. The free trade zone is a massive market. It's not going away, and it's always growing. Anyone already operating in it has a huge financial and production capacity advantage over some poor little Vyosha company. The worry is that when they eventually open a wormhole here, all our companies will lose out to cheap imports. Trade will be one way." Her mind went back to Albany, to the sheer scale of the place. "You're going to undercut them. Albany is as automated as anyone can be without replicators. I've spent a decade investing in the most advanced cybernated systems we can have to drive production costs down. To do that, to push each unit cost as low as it can physically go, you have to have massive volume production. That's what's killing me at the moment. The factories are barely ticking over. But when that wormhole finally opens, it's not going to be the financial massacre they expect. They import, I export. But the quantity of those exports will be 10 times greater than they assume. You need a distribution network." His smile was triumphant as he turned to face the lake. "Certainly would." "Wow," she said, and meant it. Lycan's ambition was so great, hers wouldn't even register on the same scale. "Why tell me? You can't be trying to impress me into bed. You've already got that. Although I have an egotistical opinion of my own ability,
I can't actually manage every aspect by myself, even with an augmented mentality. Too many details. For an expansion phase on this level, I need people I can trust in senior management positions, especially off-world. That's very flattering. Yes and no. You'd be capable management, I think. You have the right kind of drive and mindset. You don't have the experience to be top rank, but that will come. She frowned. Why me? How much research did you really do? On Sheldon himself? None, she admitted. Just what I picked up in school. The old dynasties were just that. Family enterprises. The surest way humans have ever come up with to retain loyalty and control. Nigel used his own flesh and blood. Ah. It was as if the room suddenly was on the move, downward. All the senior positions were held by his own children, Lycan said. That's also what I do. A memory abruptly rushed to the forefront of her mind. Dabina, she said before she could stop it. Lycan actually winced. What did I ever do to you? No, okay. Not my beloved little girl. But a lot of my other children are running sections of my company. And how do I fit into this? How do you think? Spell it out for me. You become one of my wives. You have my children. They take their place in the company. You really know how to romance a girl. He flashed her a wry smile. Come on, we're grown-ups. Every marriage today is half business. We'll have a great time in bed. I can afford any lifestyle you want. Your children will grow up being part of the most dynamic company in this section of the Commonwealth. They'll never want for anything, and they'll be presented with virtually unlimited challenges. I know you well enough to know that appeals. Who wants trust fund brats, right? And the same goes for you. Stick with me for 10, 15 years. Then you can either continue with a post in the company, or you cut loose with a huge chunk of money and enough insider knowledge to run circles around everyone else. Ozzy's mother! Are you serious? Perfectly. It's very flattering, but isn't it a bit sudden? You think Sheldon hesitated when he saw something he wanted? No way. He went out and got it. And this isn't quite that sudden now, is it? We had a connection back at my symposium. You're not going to deny that, are you? No, she admitted. So, there's physical attraction, which just leaves your abilities. I did some research. Your fifth assistant's coffee boy did some research. Indeed, he acknowledged wryly. You're the original kid from nowhere. Rejects the cozy family business route. Looking to get out. Failed marriage. Now on the bounce-back curve. You're hungry and capable. With the experience my organization can provide, you'll flourish. He sidled up close and put his arm around her, kissing her again, more gently this time. I don't want an answer this instant. This is why you're here. Experience everything you can and you want. Then take your time and decide. Araminta did not wear her own clothes to dinner. That was the first thing she learned about what membership in the harem would be like. A stylist called Helena was waiting in her bedroom when it collected her from Lycan's airy office. She was a jovial woman, close to rejuvenation, whose age meant she had piled on a lot of weight in recent years. Genuinely friendly, she was keen to confide household gossip, most of which made no sense to Araminta, although there was a lot of it. She had been with Lycan for 50 years. So I know it all, honey. Seen even more. I don't judge anyone, and nothing you do here is going to surprise me. You want anything special for tonight, you just ask me for it. Araminta was not sure what counted as special. It was tempting to ask what other girls had requested. One thing Helena was sure of was that Lycan likes his women elegant, so we've got to get you spruced up, ready to stand your own ground against the others. That took hours. Her bedroom bounded all over the ovoid house to link up with various specialist rooms, the sauna to start with, to clear her pores. There was a massage by a man called Nifran, who was as brutal as he was skillful. Afterward, she sort of poured herself off the table with loose, floppy limbs. Then there was the fitting room. A house that has a fitting room? Where she was measured for her evening dress. She spiraled down to the salon,
where Helena finally was exposed as a sorceress. Layers of cosmetic membrane were applied, yet when Araminta looked in the mirror, there was no sign of them. Instead, her 19-year-old self looked back at her. It was a 19 that she'd never known, but always wanted, with sharp cheekbones, absolutely no excess flesh, soft long eyelashes, perfectly clear skin, and eyes that sparkled. Another hour saw her hair repaired, as Helena disapprovingly termed the first procedure. Then it was extended, thickened, softened, waved, and styled. Clémence had the chair next to her as it was being done, and another member of the harem, Alcena, took the other side. They chatted comfortably enough, providing an insight into the kind of sisterhood the women had. She was given a rundown of Lycan's genealogy, with emphasis on the wayward children, a saga for which she needed to open a new file in a storage lacuna so that she could keep track of it. For all their friendliness, the girls were not quite engaged with the real world. That was a pretty bitchy observation, but one that Araminta felt applied. If Lycan wanted women like her, what was he doing with the others? They certainly did not aspire to run sections of his corporate empire.
"He likes variety,"
Helena told her, as the salon rendezvoused with the fitting room. The classic little black dress had never fallen out of style, and looking at the one the fitting room's apprentice sorceress had conjured up for her, Araminta could see why. She felt randy just slipping into it, so Ozzy alone knew what effect it would have on any male who crossed her path. It clung disgracefully, yet allowed her breasts complete freedom of movement. She blushed the first time she walked in it. Somehow the high hem and silk gloss microfabric sprayed on her legs made her calves and thighs slim down to that same 19-year-old ideal Helena's spell had blessed her face with for the night. Pre-dinner cocktails were served to the household and Lycan's guests in the music room, which had claimed his office's Lakeview. Araminta walked in with her head held high, knowing how great she looked. Lycan's double take, the smiles from the harem, and Clémence's little bounce as she clapped her hands excitedly, were simply the accolades she was due. It all helped buoy her confidence, close to levels of arrogance. When Lycan introduced her to the Prime Minister and her husband, she was perfectly civil and treated them as if they were almost her equals. All the while, as she made small talk and sampled weird-tasting canapés, she kept wondering how Bovey would behave if he were there. He enjoyed his culture, and could be as snobbish about food and wine as anyone. But the company she mingled with, the world's powerful and wealthy, and a few merely famous, she just couldn't get away from the idea of how he would turn his nose up at them. Yet here I am, holding my own. The evening did have a downside. The Prime Minister's husband, whom she was seated next to at the dinner table, was fantastically boring. Thankfully, Eridal, one of Lycan's older sons, sat on her other side. As smart and charming as Lycan, he ran a finance house in Ludor, but he lacked that bullish determination that drove his father. She dutifully tried to not spend the whole evening chatting to him. When it was all over, after the dining hall had descended to ground level so the guests could walk to their capsules, there was just Lycan and 8 of his harem left. The door contracted, and the walls resumed their sparkle. Everyone gave a spontaneous laugh of release that Araminta joined in wholeheartedly. Lycan gave her a congratulatory kiss.
"Damn it. I'd forgotten how awful that dickhead was," he told her. "I wanted to smack him one, and he wasn't even talking to me. Thanks for putting up with him."
Doors were opening into various bedrooms around the dining hall. The harem was vanishing through them. Of all the women at the dinner, they were undeniably the most beautiful, most of them astonishingly so. Despite all Helena's efforts, Araminta could not help but feel like the poor relation in their presence.
"Go and get ready," Lycan told her. "We'll be waiting."
He turned and left through a door into a small darkened room. Araminta stared after him for a moment, then summoned her bedroom. That whole alpha male issuing orders thing just didn't do it for her. For one, he didn't have the charisma to pull it off,
not with his dress sense and throwback physical appearance. On the other hand, to have accomplished so much was darkly compelling. She grinned at her own inner argument. What the hell? At least Clémence will be fun.
Dress me the way he'll enjoy, she told the waiting Helena. It was a process that turned out to be more elaborate than she had anticipated. For a start, it involved Nifran again, who chided her about lack of proper exercise and how he could not relax her enough. What he did with her legs was virtually sex in itself. Helena applied some fabulously scented oil that acted in conjunction with Nifran's pummeling to make her flesh glow.
He's not into sadism or anything, is he? Araminta asked. The preparations were all very detailed. Her usual idea of getting ready for a hot night was to wear something a man could remove quickly.
Not to worry, sweetie. He enjoys sex the way he enjoys his women. Tasteful.
Pondering that, Araminta allowed Helena to dress her. The white negligee was mostly straps, yet perversely managed to cover more of her body than the black dress had. She checked herself out in the mirror. So his idea of tasteful is a slut princess? How very male. Her bedroom whisked her away to Lycan's boudoir. No other word for it. Vast bed in the middle, naughty-shaped furniture, low rose-gold lighting. The harem was in attendance and, yes, dressed elegantly in silk and satin, with open gowns swirling, lounging on couches, sipping champagne as they watched two of their number make love on the bed. Araminta strolled in, trying not to appear too apprehensive. Lycan greeted her, wearing a black robe. Champagne, he offered.
Thank you.
She took a crystal flute from Maracata, who gave her a detailed appraisal. There was something alarmingly erotic about the way the aloof woman seemed able to look right through the negligee.
You two should kiss, Lycan said.
Araminta pressed herself against the statuesque woman, enjoying the sensual touch. Maracata certainly knew how to kiss. When they had finished, Araminta took a sip of the champagne as Lycan took her hand and led her slowly over to the couch, where Alcena was waiting. Araminta knelt down and began the kiss. As she went on to kiss all the other women, as he instructed, Araminta decided the experience was not so much tasteful as formulaic. Lycan had ritualized his lovemaking. Finally, she kissed him. After that, she was taken over to the bed. There was a specific way of kneeling he wanted her to assume, very sex-kittenish. One of the harem women helped arrange her hair decoratively over her shoulder. Clémence removed Lycan's gown. Araminta stared at his huge erection.
I have a gift for you.
Yes, she said emphatically. I see that.
A program.
Huh?
A mélange I've composed myself over several years. It allows you deeper access to your own mind, opening levels that verge on the subconscious in the way the old yogis achieved through meditation.
Right, she said dubiously. Talk about killing the mood. He smiled fondly and stroked her cheek.
I use it myself to focus. It helps clean your mind of extraneous thought. You can revert to the animal basics which form our core identity.
His face came close to hers. There are no inhibitions to be had in such a state. Whatever you pursue is unashamedly pure.
No inhibitions?
Clarity is a helpful tool for business, but also for lovemaking. You can concentrate on the sensations of your body to the exclusion of anything else. It helps amplify even the smallest nerve signal.
You mean I can make a climax stronger?
It sounded like an electronic version of the sex aerosols she and Bovey used.
Yes. There are also adapted biofeedback routines which can influence your physical self. Once you determine the origin of your body's pleasure, you can repeat it.
His voice became softer, tempting. As many times as you have the physical strength for. Her U-shadow told her he was offering the program. Suddenly she was feeling very hot in the negligee.
Scan it for infiltrators and Trojans, she told her U-shadow as she held his level gaze.
It's clean. Load and run. Through her exovision, she watched the program expand into one of her lacunae. It had many similarities with a learning program,
and she allowed it to mushroom into her grey matter. Instinctive knowledge bubbled away in her mind.
"Don't be afraid," Lycan said softly. "I'll use it with you. It will make our first time spectacular."
She nodded, not trusting herself to speak. Now that she considered it, clearing her mind was a simple process, following the rising sleep cycles yet never accepting them. Her breathing steadied, and she grew aware of the body's rhythms, the flow of nervous energy, heartbeat. Peripheral thoughts fell away, allowing her to center herself in the boudoir, on the bed. Her awareness grew of the light touch of fabric against her skin. Tiny beads of perspiration clung to her. She heard the sound of bubbles fizzing in the crystal flutes, Lycan's breathing. She saw his arm move out, a finger beckon. Marikata answered the summons, sliding sinuously over the mattress. Her fingers stroked Araminta's skin. The sensations her nerves experienced flowed like a tidal wave into her brain. She gasped at the impact and pulled her attention to the sensations that were most pleasurable, wallowing in them. Under Lycan's direction, Marikata plucked the negligee straps off Araminta's shoulders. Air flowed over her exposed breasts, followed by warm fingers. Araminta shuddered fiercely at the touch, smiling as she centered her mind on the feeling. Blood was loud and hot as it rushed into her nipples, swelling the buds.
"There," she told the owner of the fingers.
The caress was repeated, the ecstasy replicated. Then many hands were gliding over her. Warm, eager mouths kissed. She wailed with helpless delight at the symphony of sensation the harem kindled. The negligee was removed completely. Instinctively she arched her back. Lycan's cock slid inside her. The experience was close to unbearable. It was all there was. Still her mind remained steadfast on the torrent of physical joy. Araminta promised herself that no matter what, she would not faint away as she had with Bove. This time there were no chemicals fogging her mind. This time she was free to experience its incredible conclusion. She laughed and wept simultaneously as Lycan started to move in a powerful rhythm. Then the harem recommenced its virtuoso performance. The Sky Lord glided across the outer atmosphere of the solid planet, its vacuum wings long since retracted. Thick, turbulent streams of the ionosphere swept across its forward section, creating lengthy vibrations across its giant bulk. Energy stirred in specific patterns within it, thoughts mingling with its body's elemental power, manipulating the fabric of the universe outside. Its speed began to slow as it imposed its wishes on reality. Gently it started to lower itself into the atmosphere. Far below, the minds of the sentient entities sang out in welcome.
"Now," Cleric Conservator Ethan commanded the obedient, waiting minds of the Dream Masters. Their thoughts flared out into the Gaia field in a single stream, pushing at the dream fabric, seeking entry. Tendrils of raw will prodded and poked at the stubbornly resistant image emanating from the second dreamer. As the Sky Lord began to focus its attention on the ancient coastal city below, they felt its perception turn outward, toward them. It felt them. It knew they were there. "My lord," Ethan called with profound respect, "we need your help." The Sky Lord's descent halted. Those dreaming the Sky Lord felt the mass of the planet press against the magnificent creature's perception. In that way, they knew the winds that blew across the Uguru Plain, experienced the waves rolling lazily over the Layot Sea toward the coast. And there, right underneath them, so tantalizingly close, the physical form of Makathran's buildings brushed against their consciousness, each one exactly as it was in Inigo's dreams. Adoration and gratitude swelled out into the Gaia field, buoying Ethan's thoughts. "We seek to reach you. Show us the way to you, my lord. Receive us." The dream shattered into a glorious pinnacle of agony. The Sky Lord's magisterial thoughts were wrenched away by a terrible power.
"No,"
the second dreamer commanded amid the ruined bliss. "I am me." An infinite black surface swelled with malignant anger, sealing the gulf between the Gaia field and the Sky Lord.
Blinding pain seared deep into Ethan's mind as the blackness snapped at him. He screamed, every muscle contorting to fling him out of his chair to fall into merciful unconsciousness. Araminta woke with a gasp, shooting upright on the bed, heart racing and breath coming in shudders. She instinctively applied the program's knowledge again, settling her racing mind and quelling her body's distress. It worked perfectly. What the fuck is it with that dream? It had been quite pleasant to start with, drifting gently above a strange planet, warm sun on her back, mysterious continents rolling by underneath. Then something happened, a smothering sensation that triggered an adrenaline rush, and she had to thrash about, trying to wake herself, push herself clear from that oppressive constriction. It was as if someone were trying to steal her soul. She yelled defiance at the dark force and finally managed to wake up. She was kicking and writhing as she shouted, surely, yet actually, all she seemed to have done was shuffle around a bit and sit up. She looked about in confusion. Lycan's boudoir was still illuminated by the same warm light. Nobody else was awake. Clémence was curled up beside her, one arm draped over her legs. The girl was stirring, blinking in confusion as Araminta moved. Araminta stroked her tangled hair and cheek, soothing her as she would a troubled child. A drowsy Clémence smiled worshipfully and then closed her eyes again. Araminta blew out an exasperated breath and slowly sank back down. Despite the supple mattress, her body was stressed tight, which no doubt would annoy Nifran. As she lay there rigid, she could hear two of the harem women whimpering softly in their sleep. So she wasn't the only one suffering a bad dream. She wondered if she should creep across the room to wake them, but eventually they subsided into a deeper sleep, yet she still could not relax and drop off. There was something scrabbling about in her subconscious that was unsettling her, an elusive memory she was trying to connect, not the dream, something before that. Once again the program came to her aid. She cleared her mind and concentrated on her memories of the orgy. Physically, it had been hugely satisfying, no denying that. And the harem had delighted in teaching her a whole range of sensual acts that they and Lycan enjoyed. But it was that ritual thing again. True passion had been missing, and with it the heat that came from abandoning herself the way she did with Bove. This had been a little too much like mechanics, with all of them busy doing as Lycan instructed. Araminta sat up on the bed again, her skin cooling with shock. The memory of Lycan and Marakata was perfectly clear in her mind, all thanks to his wonderful program. And how's that for irony? She thought it through again, then reviewed some other suspicious recollections before finally dropping her head into her hands and groaning in dismay, oh shit. True to her word, Helena did not judge. She made no comment as the house emptied the drawers and closets, the clothes slithering away through the interstices between the rooms to fill her cases in the butler's lodge. Araminta almost wanted to ask how many others she had seen leave abruptly after a night with Lycan, but that would have been unfair to both of them. Her bedroom wound through the ovoid house and opened a door onto the path that ran around the outside of the building. Dawn light was shining a murky grey off the placid lake. Two of the household's smartly suited staff were loading her cases back into her carry capsule. "It's a shame, sweetie," Helena said. "I had you down as one who'd fit in easily here." "Me too," Araminta said. She gave the maid a quick hug. "Thanks for everything." "Hey, it was nice meeting you." Araminta turned and walked out of the bedroom. The door unrolled behind her. "Wait!" Clémence called out. "You can't leave!" She was hurrying out of a door 10 meters away, trying to pull on a translucent wrap. Lycan walked behind her, considerably more composed, in a thick, dark purple robe. "Not even going to say goodbye?" he asked. There was a nasty frown on his puggish face. "The house's net is active. You knew I was leaving. If you wanted to say anything before I left, you could," Araminta told him. "And here you are." "Yes, here I am. I would like to know why you're running out. I think I'm entitled after the offer I made you. I know you enjoyed yourself last night. So, what is this?"
Araminta glanced at the distraught girl who was hovering between them, uncertain who to go to.
"Are you sure?" Lycan took a step forward and put his arm around Clemence's shoulder, helping to pull her wrap on. "I don't keep anything from my wives. Even that they're psychoneural profiled?" His face remained impassive. "It was helpful to begin with."
"Helpful?" she cried. "You had them bred to be your slaves. Profiling like that is illegal. It always has been. It's a vile, inhuman thing to do. They don't have a choice. They don't have free will. It's obscene. Why, for Ozzy's sake, you don't need to force people into your bed. I probably would have joined you. And I know there are thousands of others who'd love the chance. Why did you do it?"
Lycan glanced down at Clemence with an almost paternal expression.
"They were the first," he said simply.
"First?"
"Of my harem. I had to start it somewhere. It was the bootstrap principle."
"What are you talking about?"
"To start with, when you have nothing, you begin by pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. I needed to be him, to be Nigel Sheldon. He had a harem, therefore I had one. You don't understand what that man was. He ruled hundreds of worlds, billions of people. I wasn't joking when I called him an emperor. He was the greatest human who ever lived. I need to know how to think like he did."
He almost ground the words out.
"So you created slaves to achieve that?"
"They're not slaves. All of us are predisposed to various personality traits. The way they combine, that's what makes us individuals. I just amplified a few of the behavioral attributes in the girls."
"Yeah. Submissiveness. I watched them last night, Lycan. They obeyed you like they were bots.
The relationship is a lot more complex than that.
That's what it boils down to. Why didn't you profile yourself to think like Sheldon? If you have to wreck somebody, why not yourself?"
"I have incorporated his known neural characteristics into my DNA. But a neural structure is only a vessel for personality. You need the environment as well, as complete as you can make it. Oh, for Ozzy's sake, you have deliberately, maliciously bred slaves. And you think that's an acceptable way to achieve what you are? That makes me sick. I don't want any part of you or your perverted family. You won't even let them go.
Why don't you remove their profiling when they go for a rejuvenation treatment?
I created them because of my belief, wrongly, in your opinion. Now you think they should be altered because of your belief. Does that strike you as slightly ironic?
There's an old saying that two wrongs don't make a right. I take responsibility for my wives, especially the profiled ones, just as Sheldon would have done."
Araminta glowered at him, then switched her attention to Clemence, softening her expression to plead.
"Come with me. Come away from here. It's reversible. I can show you what it's like to be free, to be truly human. I know you don't believe me, but just please try. Try, Clemence."
"You're such a fool," the girl said. She pressed harder into Lycan.
"I'm not profiled. I like this. I like being in the harem. I like the money. I like the life. I like that my children will rule whole planets. Without Lycan, what will yours ever be?"
"Themselves," Araminta said weakly.
Clemence gave her a genuinely pitying look. "That's not good enough for me."
Araminta raised an uncertain hand.
"Is she?"
"There were only ever three," Lycan said. "Clemence is not one of them. Would you like to guess again?"
Araminta shook her head. She didn't trust herself to speak.
"Maracata."
"Maracata is one, I know. Perhaps if I just..."
"Goodbye," Lycan said.
Araminta climbed into the carry capsule and told it to take her home.
Oscar had never thought he would return to the very place where he had died. Of course, he had not expected to see Paula Mayo again either. To make matters worse, enterprising, faraway natives had turned his last desperate hyperglide flight into a tourist attraction. Worse still, it was a failing attraction. Still, at least Oscar had gotten to name the brand new starship ANA had delivered to Oricum for him, and without much thought went and called it the Elvin's Payback. There was a large briefing file sitting in its smart core, which he zipped through,
and then sent a few queries to Paula, who by then was back in her own starship and en route to somewhere. She wouldn't say where. After he had finished the file, one thing became very clear to him. Paula had overestimated his abilities severely. There were a lot of very powerful, very determined groups searching for the second dreamer. Now, that might not have fazed Paula, but... "I'm only a pilot," he repeated to her when she called him on a secure TD channel and asked him why he was flying too far away. She hadn't said she could track Elvin's payback, but somehow he wasn't surprised. "I'm going to need help, and as you trust me, so I trust someone else." He got an evil little buzz out of not telling her who, though he suspected she would know. It was hardly hyperspace science. He landed at the Armstrong City Starport, a huge field to the northeast of the city, with four big terminal buildings handling passenger flights and a grid of warehouses where freighters came and went. He picked out a parking pad near the fence, away from any real activity. As the starship descended, he swept its visual sensors across the ancient city that spread back from the shore of the North Sea. Inevitably, there was a dense congregation of tall towers and pyramids above the coast, while broad estates of big houses swamped the land behind. It was all a lot more chaotic than the layout of most Commonwealth cities, which he rather enjoyed. He was looking for a glimpse of Highway 1, the historic road where his friends had chased the Starflyer to its doom. All that remained was a long, fat urban strip, following the old route as it struck out for miles across the great Iril steppes, as if city buildings were seeking to escape from their historical anchor at the center. As in every Commonwealth world, Faraway's ground traffic was a shrinking minority. The sky above the city swarmed with regrav capsules. Oscar floated down out of the airlock underneath Elvin's payback and stood once more on the ground of Faraway. For some ridiculous reason, he was trembling. He took a long moment, breathing in the air, then moved away from the starship. His feet pushed gently on the short grass, sending his body gliding in a short arc in the low gravity. He had forgotten how enjoyable that part of this world was. Those sore hop steps were a freedom like having teenage hormones again. Once he'd cleared the ship, he stopped and turned a full circle. There was the city skyline on one side, some distant mountains, nothing he recognized apart from the glorious sapphire sky. Thankfully, that remained the same as the planet's biosphere slowly regenerated with the new plants and creatures humans had brought to this world. Warm sea air gusted constantly from the passage of starships using the terminals, ruffling his hair. It was all very different from Arakam's main starport, which he had flown from, supporting barely 50 flights a day. But then, Faraway was the self-proclaimed capital of the external worlds, the planet that had refused political and economic integration with the Greater Commonwealth. Even today it was technically only an affiliate member. Its staunch independence had inspired a whole generation of newly settled worlds after the Starflyer War. The political will, coupled with the end of CST's transport monopoly that the starships had brought, allowed the first cultural division to open within Commonwealth society as a whole. As the Sheldon dynasty had made Bionics available, starting higher culture, Faraway's Barsoomians had introduced genetic improvements that took the human body far beyond its natural meridian, developing into the Advancer movement. After that, Faraway, with its fierce libertarianist tradition, declared itself the ideological counterweight to Earth and ANA. The Commonwealth senators might regard the notion with their ancient, wise disdain, but Faraway citizens believed in their own destiny. Oscar smiled at the busy city as he experienced the emotional tide of the local Gaia field. Even that had a stridency that celebrated the stubbornness of the inhabitants. His U-shadow opened a channel to the planetary cybersphere and called a one-time address code he had been given 86 years earlier, on the day he had emerged from the Relife Clinic. To his surprise, it was answered immediately. "Yes?" "I need to see you," Oscar said. "I have a problem, and I need help sorting it out."
"Who the fuck are you, and how did you steal this code?"
"I am Oscar Munro, and this code was given to me some time ago." There was a long pause, though the channel remained open. If you are an impostor, you have one chance to walk away, and that chance is now. I know who I am, Oscar said. We'll know if you are.
Good.
Very well. Be at the Kaim Sanctuary on top of Mount Herculaneum in 1 hour. One of us will meet you. The channel went dead. Oscar grinned. He shouldn't be all fired up by this. He really shouldn't. His U-Shadow contacted a local hire company, and he rented a high-performance Ingrav capsule. Given who he was going to meet, he did not want to risk technology leakage by arriving in an ultra-drive ship. The capsule bounced him over to Mount Herculaneum in a semi-ballistic lob that took 28 minutes. The last time he'd seen the colossal volcano had been the day he had died by crashing into its lower slopes. This time his arrival was a lot more comfortable. The capsule shot out of the upper atmosphere and followed the planet's curvature southwest. He watched through the sensors as the Grand Triad rose up out of the horizon. They were still the biggest mountains to be found on an H-congruous world. On a planet with standard gravity, they would have collapsed under their own weight. But here they had kept on growing as the magma pushed farther and farther upward. Mount Herculaneum, the biggest, stood 32 kilometers high, its plateau summit rising high above Faraway's troposphere. Northward, Mount Zeus topped out at 17 kilometers. South of Herculaneum, Mount Titan reached up 23 kilometers. It was the only one of the triad to remain active. Oscar's capsule rode a tight curve above the sea-like grasslands of the Aldrin Plains before it began to sink again. The view was magnificent, with the vast cone of Herculaneum spread out below him. Its plateau of grubby brown regolith was broken by twin calderas. Around that, naked rock dropped down to the glacier ring far below, before the lower slopes finally were smothered in pine forests and low meadowland. Luckily for him, Titan was semi-active today. He looked down almost vertically into its glowing red crater, watching the slow-motion ripples spreading out across the huge lake of lava. Radiant white boulders spit upward out of the inferno to traverse lazy arcs through the vacuum, spitting orange sparks. Some of them were flung far enough to clear the crater wall and begin a long fall to oblivion. His sight inevitably was drawn to the long funnel canyon between Zeus and Titan that led to the base of Herculaneum. Stakeout Canyon was where the storm winds coming off the Hondu Ocean were funneled into a rampaging blast of air. The insane thrill-seekers of the early Commonwealth used to fly their hypergliders on winds so strong that they'd push them out of the atmosphere and over Herculaneum. He'd never gotten to attempt that last part, crashing his hyperglider into Anna, so that Wilson might stand a chance to reach the summit. Even though he had braced himself for an emotional shockwave at seeing the sight of his death, he felt nothing more than mild curiosity. That must mean I'm perfectly adjusted to this new life, right? As he looked along the long rocky cleft in the ground, his exovision pulled up meteorological data and a file telling him that the winds now were never as strong as they had been 1,000 years ago. Transforming had calmed Faraway's atmosphere. Hypergliding was just a legend now. The capsule took him down to a big dome situated right on the eastern edge of Mount Herculaneum's plateau, where the cliffs of Aphrodite's Seat began their sheer 8-kilometer fall. There was a pressure field over the entrance to the dome's landing chamber, a big metal cave with enough room for 20 passenger capsules. It had only 2 resting inside, with another 5 ordinary capsules parked nearby. Oscar stepped through the airlock pressure curtains into the dome's main arena and paid his 20 FA dollar entrance fee from a credit coin Paula had given him. There were 3 low buildings inside, lined up behind Aphrodite's Seat. He went over to the first, which the dome's net labeled Crash Site. A whole bunch of tourists were just exiting from it, heading for the cafe next door, chatting excitedly. They never registered him, which he found amusing. It wasn't as if his face was any different now. It was dark inside, with 1 wall open to the side of the dome above the cliffs. A narrow winding walkway was suspended 3 meters over the ground, with a pressure field below it, maintaining a vacuum over the actual regolith. There was also a stabilizer field generator running to preserve the wreckage of the hyperglider. The once elegant fuselage was crunched into the side of a rock outcrop, with the plastic wings bent and snapped. Oscar remembered how elegant those wings had been, fully extended, and sighed. He walked slowly along the walkway until he was directly above the antique. His heart had slowed as he imagined his friend, terrified and frantic, as the craft skidded along the dusty plateau, slipping and twisting, completely out of control. The fate of an entire species depended on the outcome as the cliffs rushed toward him. Oscar frowned as he looked down. The hyperglider was actually upside down, which meant there had been an almighty flip at one point. He looked along the ground to the rim of Aphrodite's seat, where someone in an ancient pressure suit was sitting. It was a solido projection, Oscar realized as he came to the end of the walkway. Wilson Keim, his head visible in a not terribly authentic bubble helmet. The pressure suit rips had been repaired with some kind of epoxy, leaking blood into the regolith. The solido Wilson stared out over the Dassault mountain range to the east, where the snow-capped peaks diminished into the bright blaze of the curving horizon. This was exactly what the real Wilson had seen, what so many people had died to give him, those which history knew and still more unknown. 1,200 years ago, this glorious panorama had provided the data to steer a giant storm into the Starflyer's ship, slaying the beast and liberating the Commonwealth. Today, here, on that same spot, he could sit in the Savior View Cafe next door and buy donuts named after him. Without you, we wouldn't be here. Oscar started. There was a man standing behind him on the walkway, wearing a very dark toga suit. Great secret agent I make. Anyone can creep up on me. Excuse me, Oscar said. The man smiled. He was very handsome, with a square jaw, a dimpled chin, and a flattish nose. Brown eyes were surrounded by laughter lines. When he opened his wide mouth, startlingly white teeth smiled out. I nearly got blown away by that burst of melancholy disappointment you let loose into the Gaia field, he said. It's understandable. He waved a hand around the darkened chamber. This travesty is all that exists to celebrate what you and Wilson achieved. But I promise you, we know and appreciate what you did. It is taught to all of our children. We, the man bowed his head formally, the Knight's Guardian. Welcome to Far Away, Oscar Munro. How can we help you? His name was Tomancio, he said as they walked back to Oscar's capsule. In full, Tomancio McFoster Stewart. It was my father who provided you with our code 86 years ago. I barely saw him. The government had a tight little cordon around my room. They were anxious that I should have my privacy. Yet he just walked right in, and out again, too. We thought you'd forgotten us, Tomancio said. Or worse. I'm not what I used to be, Oscar said. At least, that's what I thought. And yet here you are. It's an interesting time to come and seek us out again, for both the greater Commonwealth and the galaxy at large. Not the kind of time a man chooses to indulge in nostalgia. No, this has nothing to do with nostalgia. They sat themselves in the capsule. Do you mind if I navigate? Tomancio asked. You would find it difficult to reach our lands unaided. Of course, Oscar said. His curiosity rose as they slid out of the dome's landing chamber. Where are your lands? Where they've always been. From the northeast corner of the Dassault Mountains all the way to the Oak Sea. The capsule began to accelerate, streaking northward over the mountains as it gained altitude. For the first time, Oscar saw the high desert around which the lofty peaks huddled protectively. And I couldn't find you. That peak is Mount St. Omer, isn't it? The Marie Celeste crashed close by. Knowing and reaching are two separate things. I didn't know you all turned Buddhist and spoke in fortune cookies. Tomancio tilted his head to one side with avian precision. His attractive smile was poised. Ah, I see. I'm not being deliberately enigmatic, though perhaps I am guilty of over-dramatizing. But you are very precious to us, Oscar. I'm hoping to impress you. Just for a moment, Oscar felt as if he had lived through every one of those 1,100 years. He had to history mine to understand me. Jesus fuck. He had been far too sheltered with his life partners.
Small wonder he always felt as if the house put up a cozy barrier between his little family and the outside world.
"We protect our lands with a tisvair," Timancio said.
"Really? I thought only Earth had one."
"We don't advertise. It's actually quite an elegant defense on many levels, although it does require a colossal amount of energy to maintain. If you walk or drive or fly toward us, as you approach our border, you're simply teleported to the other side. You can't knock on a door, which you never face. You have to be invited in."
"Cool."
The lands they fell toward seemed particularly lush, thick greenery split by meandering rivers, forest and meadowland squabbling to dominate valleys and rolling hills. Always to the east there was a glimpse of the Oak Sea. They re-entered the atmosphere. Strands of cloud rushed up past the capsule's transparent hull, thickening fast. Then they were through, and a forest canopy unfolded below them, leaves of every color, trees of immense size. Faraway had always celebrated its unique genetic diversity. Starting with a nearly sterile landscape, the terraforming teams had brought the seeds of 100 planets with them to create the ultimate contrasting florascape.
"Here we go," Timancio said as their altitude approached 3 miles.
The view outside suddenly switched. Oscar jumped in his seat. They were floating 100 yards above the ground at the head of a long valley. Blue-green grass rippled away for miles on every side, lapping against woodlands that spilled out of the dips in the valley walls. There were houses all around them, built from wood and stone, blending nicely with the environment, like a medieval village back on Earth, but on a much grander scale.
"You live here?" Oscar asked.
"Yes."
"I'm envious.
Appearances can be deceiving."
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.